This episode is brought to you by Oddmost Pizza in Canby. Handmade awesome pizza plus craft beer, cider, and wine delivered. Call them today at 503-266-8444.
This episode is also brought to you by the Canby Liquor Store. Father's Day is coming, and they really have everything that your dad really wants. From hand-selected gifts you won't find anywhere else, to small batch bourbons and unique craft beers. Find them in the Fred Meyer Shopping Center. Welcome to the Canby Now podcast.
Your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Thousands of Canby students will have to wait a little longer before they can step foot inside a classroom again. The Canby School District is no longer planning to reopen facilities to start the 2020-2021 academic year due to strict new COVID-19 metrics the state unveiled last week, which Clackamas County is nowhere close to meeting. Based on these metrics, Canby School District will not be permitted to return to schools on September 8th in the setting we have proposed. Superintendent Tripp Goodall informed families by email Wednesday. We hope the transition into an in-person learning model will be possible later this fall. Instead, the district will be offering two alternative learning models when school resumes in September, connected at-home learning, a temporary distance learning model for students who plan to return to our schools when the in-person learning is permitted, and the Canby Online Learning Academy, a 100% online platform that provides self-directed curriculum through Edgenuity and Odysseyware. Support for students in dual language immersion programs will also be available. The district said it will also provide full services to students on IEPs, those with 504 plans, TAG students, migrant students, and English learners with individualized supports that will be integrated into the Connect at Home learning model. Any student who wants to enroll in Canby Online Learning Academy must apply by Wednesday, August 5th, and must commit for a full term, semester or trimester, depending on your school. This is not the news we were hoping to share, Superintendent Goodall admitted. We recognize the importance of role schools play in the lives of our students, families, and for our community. Our staff have been looking forward to solving the unique challenges we're facing to work directly with students in our classrooms. We are hopeful that the opportunity will still happen this fall. For more information and links, find the story on our website, canbynowpod.com. Only 5 new cases of the novel coronavirus were reported for the Canby zip code this week, ending Sunday, July 26th, the lowest weekly increase the community has seen in almost 2 months. It was a marked decrease from the previous week, when the city's number of new cases was more than 3 times higher. The primary driver for Canby's numbers in the month of June was a large outbreak at Marquis Hope Village, which is now considered resolved. Canby has now seen 164 confirmed cases, the second highest in the county behind neighboring Oregon City's 183. Canby's per capita infection rate, though, is much higher because of the population differences, 72.3 per 10,000 residents versus 35.6 for Oregon City. Canby's infection rate is also far above that of the state as a whole, 40 cases per 10,000 Oregonians. Statewide, hospitalizations of 21 to 24 per day are now just on par with the March and April peaks of 20 to 25 per day, despite reported daily case counts more than three times as high. Officials said this is most likely due to detection and testing that has greatly improved since the early days of the pandemic and an increased infection rate in young, healthy people who are at much lower risk for hospitalization or death. In Oregon, half of all the cases are from people under the age of 40, and those in their 20s and 30s are now the group most likely to get sick with COVID-19. ICU bed usage remains well below capacity statewide. Oregon Governor Kate Brown announced this week that she will convene a second special session of the Oregon legislature starting Monday, August 10th, to address the state's devastating budget shortfall that has arisen in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. This crisis has impacted all of us. Oregon families, businesses, nonprofits, and local governments have all had to cut costs, she said in a press statement Friday. The state of Oregon has been tightening its belt as well. With a nearly $1 billion budget deficit in the current biennium, there is more work to do. She admitted the decisions facing the state will not be easy, but must be addressed this biennium to prevent even more difficult choices down the line. Unlike the federal government, Oregon must balance our state budget, she said. State and local governments have been left reeling from the economic downturn. For months, we have waited for Congress to take action, and it is still my hope that they will include aid for states and local governments in the coronavirus relief package currently being negotiated. Governor Brown highlighted the need to preserve critical services like healthcare, education, and senior services during the pandemic, along with addressing the disparities in state support for Oregon's undeserved communities, particularly Black, Indigenous, Latinx, Pacific Islander, and other communities of color. I would like to thank legislators for beginning this work already, and I look forward to rolling up our sleeves and crafting an updated budget that serves all Oregonians, she said. Later Friday, Senator Republican leader Fred Gyrod of Staten offered the governor a bit of left-handed praise for finally calling a special session to address the budget shortfall. Senate Republicans have been willing to work on the budget since before the governor called this first special meeting earlier this summer, Gyrod said in a statement. Though the governor noted her support for the legislature to also build on matters considered in the first special session, including additional police accountability reforms, Gyrod signaled that the GOP contingent would show little patience for this course. If we diverge from the state purpose of addressing the budget, this second special session will make a mockery of the legislative process yet again, he said. Policy bills should be off the table. The focus should be on the budget. Commissioners castigated Oregon Governor Kate Brown this week for continuing to withhold meaningful coronavirus relief funding from Clackamas County, while funneling hundreds of millions in federal dollars to its Portland metro area neighbors. In a statement from county leaders Wednesday, they said the governor's decision to tether Clackamas to Washington and Multnomah counties for reopening has highlighted the funding imbalance in the state. While $247 million is being spent in the region by other counties and cities in the region, Clackamas County received only a fraction of the needed revenue from the Federal Coronavirus Relief Fund, CARES Act. The state's promise to reimburse the county $5.6 million for its pandemic response before May 15th arrived this week, 2 months after the funds were approved by the Oregon State Legislature. Commissioners say Governor Brown has ignored Clackamas County's plea for $45 million to provide life-saving services to residents and businesses in order to survive the COVID-19 pandemic. The governor expects our region to reopen and work together, says Chair Jim Bernard. But while Portland and the other two counties in the region are spending hundreds of millions of dollars for public health, housing, people in need, and economic relief, Clackamas County is left looking at a list of needs and requirements it can't possibly meet. Added Commissioner Sonia Fesher, quote, "The state is asking our region to build something together, but seems okay that Clackamas doesn't have the adequate resources to do so." Clackamas County's Emergency Operations Center estimates it needs $45 million from the CARES Act to provide an adequate response to match the region. Without it, critical opportunities will be lost to invest in economic recovery and housing. It is simply unfair to couple Clackamas County to the metro area counties, both of which received CARES Act funding, but profoundly unfair to not to provide us with our share, says Commissioner Paul Savas. This is an injustice to Clackamas County, its residents, and businesses. Clackamas County's $45 million request for CARES Act funds would support increased COVID-19 testing, hire more contact tracers, keeping people housed, and programs to help businesses survive. Washington County received a direct allocation of $105 million of CARES Act funds. The city of Portland received $114 million. Multnomah County received $28 million. Finally, an idea for a new business that doesn't stink. Well, I mean, kind of, but you'll figure it out. Canby 13-year-old Keaton Hutt is the turd herder, a local kidrapreneur who is in the business of taking care of Fido's business. That's right, for a nominal fee, $5 a week after a $30 startup fee, Hunt and his 10-year-old sister, Kira Huff, will clean up dog waste from your yard. It's not an unheard-of business venture for enterprising youngsters, but Keaton has unusually slick brand and social media presence that's largely thanks to his mother, Annie Wardle, who owns a digital marketing agency. Wardle said the kids started the business 3 years ago when the family was living in Colorado. My kids kept asking me to buy them stuff and told me I owed them money for chores, she recalls. I do not pay for chores because I believe in order to run a smooth household, we all have to contribute. If you want something, you have to work for it, just like I do. It was a real turning point for the family, Wardle explained. I felt like I had some realization that my kids were spoiled as shit, and I was done with it, she remembered. I wasn't about to raise a bunch of spoiled, give-me-everything type of kids. Wardle said that she would help with the marketing, but the kids would be responsible for all the details. The work, the clients, budgeting, and managing their own expenses. They each have their own checking and savings account. The first 15% of their earnings goes into savings, and they have to pay for their own bags and gloves. Outside of that, they keep every penny, Wardle says. Keep being a relative term, of course. Keaton has bought himself a $130 electric scooter, a camera for his PlayStation, $100 Bluetooth wands for his VR, Wardle says. They now know that if they want something and it's not their birthday or Christmas, they ask, how much money is in my account? I really want XYZ. I tell them how much they have and how much they still need, and they're able to save up for what they want. Keaton and Kira scooped up clients in Colorado Springs and later Castle Rock, and the profits piled up. Wardle says the experience helped him learn a lot through budgeting and the real value of a dollar. Since moving to Canby, they even broached subjects like sales tax. The kids are big fans of the no sales tax system, as we all are. It's opened up conversations about having to pay sales tax in Colorado and why they need to save money, Wardle says, but also about saving and budgeting. So it's been a great teaching/learning experience for all of us. Now that he's settled down after the big move, the turd herder is, again, on duty and actively seeking new clients. For more information and links, you can find the story on our website, canbynowpod.com. Police beat for the week of June 16th all the way to June 29th. It's actually 2 weeks, not just one. On June 16th at 7.05 a.m., there is a report of theft from 3 vehicles overnight, as well as 8 a.m. report of theft from 2 unlocked vehicles overnight. At 8.35 a.m., theft of items from an unlocked vehicle. At 10.05 a.m., response to a non-injury traffic crash. 4.06 p.m., report of theft of a bicycle from a backyard at a residence. And 8.42 p.m., report of burglary after an unknown person used a garage door opener from an unlocked vehicle to enter a residence through the garage. Seems pretty useless to have a key to your house in an unlocked vehicle ready for anybody to push. On June 17th at 1:34 a.m., response to a report of suspicious vehicle driving slowly through a neighborhood. Officers located the suspect and seized methamphetamine and restricted weapons from the driver. Because we all know that if you have illegal stuff with you, look more suspicious. This person follows my example. With 11.08 p.m., a subject sitting on a bench in a closed city park was contacted and subsequently arrested for possession of methamphetamine, criminal trespass, and violation of his conditions of post-prison supervision. June 19th at 6:35 a.m., response to a report of a person being loud at a park. The transient man was contacted and warned about his behavior, most likely in a quiet tone. At 11:36 a.m., a non-injury traffic crash involving a motorcycle and utility trailer. At 4:12 p.m., report of a pedestrian taking a vacuum cleaner that had been temporarily placed on the sidewalk while the carpet to the place was being installed in the home. The officers located the pedestrian at their residence, who explained that they believed that the vacuum was free. The vacuum was then returned to its owner. So, moral of the story, don't take things that don't say big old free on the cardboard sign in front of it. At 4:24 p.m., report of a criminal mischief after a vehicle's owner realized all the lug nuts had been loosened from their front tire. That's terrifying. And 8:54 p.m., response to a report of hit and run damage to a totally innocent, obviously, you know, parked vehicle. Wasn't doing anything. Officers located the uninsured suspect vehicle and arrested, cited and released, the driver for hit and run and reckless driving. On June 23rd at 7:45 p.m., response to a report of a suspicious vehicle. One of the vehicle's occupants was arrested on felony patrol violation warrant, and the second person was arrested for identity theft, possession of methamphetamine, and heroin. Also theft. That's always nice. A little follow-up there. June 24th at 1 p.m., an unknown person scratched an expletive into the paint of a parked vehicle. Oh my goodness, that is just not hilarious. I don't want to laugh at that at all. At 9:57, an uninsured vehicle was stopped and the suspended driver was arrested for possession and distribution of methamphetamine and for felon in possession of a restricted weapon. On June 26th at 4:09 p.m., a cat passenger was trespassed from using the bus service after refusing to deboard following a verbal altercation. At 7:57 p.m., report of a pedestrian being bitten by a loose dog. If we were going to put all these together, that story would be person gets off bus and immediately gets bitten by dog. On June 27th at 9:27 a.m., report of an unknown person deflating the tire of a vehicle parked near a park entrance. At 9:32 a.m., report of a person throwing stolen fruit in the parking lot of a grocery store. The suspect was trespassed from the property. At 8.08 p.m., an uninsured vehicle being driven by a suspended driver was stopped. Heroin and prohibited controlled substances were seized from the vehicle prior to impound. On June 28th at 12.36 p.m., theft of yard tools from the front porch of a residence. 5.47 p.m., report of a person threatening a delivery driver. 5.54 p.m., response of a report of an argument between neighbors, and 10 p.m. response to a report of a person refusing to leave a grocery store because the person had previously been trespassed from the location he was cited. Basically, people were having a bad day on June 28th. The heat was probably really getting to them. That or the COVID or the masks or just, you know, the parked vehicles are pissing them off. On June 29th at 12.01 a.m., report of a juvenile shoplifting beer from a convenience store. At 2 p.m., report of hit-and-run damage to a parked vehicle. At 3.20 p.m., response to a non-injury traffic accident. At 7.05 p.m., following a traffic stop, the driver was cited in lieu of arrest for shoplifting and possession of methamphetamine. Because obviously we wouldn't arrest him for the possession of methamphetamine. We just let him go. The passenger was also cited in lieu of arrest on a Marion County misdemeanor warrant. Hey, Frankie, do you ever wonder why some businesses aren't, like, more transparent?
Oh, yeah. Like, some of the old buildings downtown are so dark. Get some more windows,
no,
you know?
No. I mean, like, transparent as in being open and honest about their business practices.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, DirectLink is a good example. They don't have internet data caps or charge extra fees for high usage.
Oh, yeah. Which is great with all the internet I've been using since this whole COVID situation started.
They also don't charge infrastructure build fees like some other providers. And they're active in our community, too. Check out their philanthropic efforts at directlink.coop/community.
Did you know that they also hold an annual meeting every year where members can talk directly with the board of directors and upper management?
Talk about transparent. You won't see any other companies being that accessible. DirectLink really is here for us. Call 503-266-8111 or visit directlink.coop. to learn more today.
Candy conversation today, we're going to be talking about, not candy, we're going to be talking about our neighbor, Aurora, and its history as a colony. And joining us to tell us a little bit about that, as well as an upcoming fundraiser, we have Spud Spurb. Hi, Spud.
Hello.
How are you?
Just great. It's a beautiful day.
Yes, it is. Nice day to be out on the old homestead, huh?
Yes, indeed.
As well as Carolyn Queer. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. How are you, Tyler?
I'm doing well, thank you. But why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and what you do here.
Well, I have been living in Aurora. I've been a citizen of Aurora for about 44 years. And
Is that all?
Just a short time. A number of years ago, probably 8 or 10 years ago, the curator of the Aurora Colony Historical Society, Patrick Harris, approached me and said that we have a plan to build a new preservation and research facility. And Spud, since you are the building official, current building official for the city of Oregon City, and I had worked with Patrick when he was working at the Museum of the Oregon Territory, and he said, we'd really like you to come on board and become involved in that project. And
yeah.
So I joined the board, I don't know, probably 8 years ago. And very shortly after that, I started working on a new preservation research facility, which had been in the museum's long-range plan for a number of years.
Yeah.
And we came to the realization that we needed more space.
Yeah.
We had a bunch of buildings. We had a lot of artifacts. And as one of our members used to say, we were just one match away from not being in existence. Priceless artifacts in a non-controlled environment. Right. No fire suppression, no heat, no humidity control.
Almost all of them made of wood.
or textiles or papers. All very consumable and combustible.
Yes.
And so that's really how I became involved in the organization, was coming on board to help with this new building. It was about a five-year project, and I was pretty heavily involved in it. So, but it's really been a great pleasure. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. This organization is a nonprofit organization. It's a listed nonprofit, 501c3.
Uh-huh.
And it relies heavily, as most organizations of this nature do, on volunteers. We don't have any real source of income other than the activities that we put on. We have a living history program that we put on in the spring for fourth grade students to tell them about living on a farm in 1870. Runs 5 days a week, got five stations. Each station has got one person or two people to it. Sometimes we have two activities going on at the same time. So the need for volunteer work is really there.
Yeah.
And I became involved in that aspect of it and really, really enjoyed it. It's just a great thrill for me as well as the other volunteers that do that. And it's, you know, it's all year long. There's, you know, the quilt shows going on. We have a fundraising dinner. We have a beer garden. So there's endless opportunities for vast amounts of volunteers.
Yeah.
And I've been pretty active the last couple of years. I'd say the last 5 or 6 years in being volunteers. And started out on the board and ended up being the, I'm the past president of the organization.
Yeah.
And was pretty much in charge of our new preservation research facility. Very, very proud of that. We built a 5,800 square foot state-of-the-art building with temperature, humidity controlled fire suppression, tune of about $1.7 million. Did that through donations and fundraising efforts. We've managed to pay off about cover all but about 100,000 of that. So
that's amazing.
It is. That's a lot of money to raise.
Yeah.
for a small organization.
The state of Oregon did also provide us with some opportunity for grants too. So there's a chunk of that was from some grant money that we got too, but mostly all donations.
Yeah.
The Will family, the Kearneys, were very generous, and the building is actually named for their family.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, I'd love to hear more, Carolyn, about being a business manager of a nonprofit that relies primarily on events and programs.
Right. Well,
in a time when those are not really allowed.
Exactly. Exactly. So, I'm part-time with the company. I've been here about 2.5 years. We've just been forging ahead. We've had kind of an impactful year, not just because of COVID, but because of our executive director, Patrick Harris, had a major stroke in January and then succumbed to that in April. And so in his memory and in his honor, we're forging ahead with trying to figure out opening and events in a COVID environment. And so it's taking all of us, myself, my colleague Christina Leader, who is our event coordinator and volunteer coordinator, and she calls herself party planner. With us together and with the help of our wonderful board, we couldn't do it without them. So we're just going forward. We made an appeal in June for some donations and to help establish an endowment in Patrick's name, and people have been responsive to that, and it's very, very humbling, and we're so grateful for people's generosity.
Yeah, it's been a very challenging year.
Yeah.
Most of our fundraising activities required you know, participation. We'd have banquets, we'd have a beer garden, and obviously with the school, the living history program, the school's being canceled. That's not happening, and you know, and then Patrick's death, and then we had taken on a large debt. So it was like everything just happened to come together at the worst possible time. But due to the efforts of a great deal of very talented people, we're moving ahead, and like everybody else, we're trying to adapt, we're trying to figure out how this is, how we're going to survive in this environment.
It changes every day.
It does. It changes every day. We closed. We closed in mid-March, and we have not been open. So we are right now in the process of trying to figure out how we're gonna open this. We're gonna open 3 days a week.
2 days a week.
2 days a week.
Wednesdays and Fridays, by appointment.
By appointment.
And
Saturday.
No, not Saturday.
No Saturday.
No. Right now it's by appointment only for Wednesday and Friday. We're going to try that out, see how things go. Like I said, it's going to be kind of a plan in action, or a plan in change,
right,
movement, whatever.
Yeah.
But we're going to figure out what works, and if it, if this works out, then we can expand it a little bit.
Uh-huh.
We are going to be having the courtyard open the 8th of August in participation with the Aurora Visitors Association farm market slash street fair, and our admission will be half price. We'll have some demonstrations of blacksmithing, spinning, we hope weaving, and maybe some other things. Somebody might be baking some bread or cookies,
but no active
participation right at this point because of guidelines.
Oh, and I love, Carolyn, the hand-crocheted masks that Spud did that the blacksmith are going to wear that are made out of animal hide, I believe. We're so creative.
Cow hide, I heard.
Yeah, you have two options, either with fur or without fur.
Oh, gotcha.
Okay.
You well, when can it have gets a beard or not have a
beard. When it gets a little cooler, you might want to opt for the fur.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, we do have a fundraiser coming up as well.
Yes.
Is that right?
Right.
Who wants to tell me about that?
Well,
go ahead, Carolyn.
Okay, so it's in the planning stages right now. We're going to have an online event. It'll be our annual auction on the 29th of August. We'll have information on our Facebook page, Old Aurora Colony Museum. I believe that's what it is, sorry. And our internet, or our webpage is www.auroracolony.org. So we'll have information about that up on those pages as soon as we can. More than likely, we will open up the auction information page 2 weeks before the 29th of August. Yep, something like that. And I'm not sure what all is going to be available, but we hope to have some really good stuff. We're working on that.
Well, I know when you were talking as well, Spud, about the, you know, how COVID has affected nonprofits. That's a huge thing, right? The auctions.
It is.
Normal year, it's like every single weekend in the Canby Aurora area, there's multiple auctions, and I know some other places have had to auction for the virtual model, and that's been successful.
It has been, and we're hoping it will be for us too.
Yes, because people want to give, and they want—I mean, they don't just go to the auctions just for something.
Right.
It's a chance to get together. It's a chance to get together with people, socialize, have a good time, right here in this courtyard for the last 2 years. On the last weekend of August, we've had that auction as well as a auction dinner. We were able to secure a gentleman who does Indian style salmon barbecue.
Oh wow.
Builds a pit, puts them up on
delicious steaks.
It is absolutely melt in your mouth. The retired Army Colonel Fred Broadwater comes out and does the salmon for us, and everybody sits around and we have side dishes and this absolutely wonderful melt in your mouth salmon. But that's all changed.
Yeah.
We can't.
It's going to be a to-go dinner.
Yeah.
Oh,
with
cool.
Arlene Cuisine, who is a new local.
Yeah, local here to Aurora, caterer.
Caterer.
Correct.
Yeah.
And Fred Broadwater will be making his salmon.
I don't have prices right yet. My right arm, Christina, had to take an appointment, and we'll have that information on the webpage and on the Facebook page.
We'll include these links in the show notes for this episode for you guys to check out.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So Fred will be having his barbecue pit set up. It's a very simple operation, but very, very effective.
Yeah.
And people will order in advance their dinners, and it will still give them an opportunity to support the museum, as well as enjoy a delicious meal. And it's a way for us to carry on somewhat in a modified edition, but that's part of what we do.
Right, right. Well, that was going to be, we're almost out of time here, but my last question is just, obviously, in challenging times like this especially, it takes a lot of work to do what you guys do. Why do you think it's so important to preserve the collection and the things that you have here, and really the way of life that you've preserved here?
Well, it's a very unique story, the Aurora Colony. You know, it was the largest utopian religious community west of the Mississippi, which is very, very unique. And you know, there are other organizations, but the whole town is on the National Historic Site. The town is predominantly known as an antique capital.
Right.
History is what we do.
Right, right. And I mean, you talk about the size of it, but as well, I was listening to a podcast, I think Offbeat Oregon, that told the story of Aurora and pointed out something as well that was unique. I mean, Oregon has other utopian societies and things that have been formed, but Aurora, pretty unique in that it is remembered in very positive ways.
Yes.
I mean, it was successful in many ways, probably one of the most successful that we know of, societies like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
two generations worth, right? Because it started out in
Right, and it's not some shameful memory. I mean, people still talk about it. We have this wonderful museum preserving it.
Yeah, the only reason that it kind of went out of existence was because the next generation had better, or not maybe not better, but different ideas on how to live and how to make money and things like that.
Right.
And for that reason, the colony itself was disbanded. But it's here today.
Right. Right.
And Dr. Kyle was a phenomenal leader.
Right.
You know, to uproot 400 people and take them by wagon across the United States and have 400 people follow, you have to be somewhat charismatic to do that,
right.
You know. And so after his death in 1888, it kind of, they disbanded the colony. And, that was, he was really the driving force.
Right.
But as you indicated, it was a very positive force, and it is looked on in our history as a very positive thing. There was wasn't bad. It was a good thing, and
a part of Oregon to be proud of.
Yeah,
part of Oregon's history.
And we have, you know, 53 years. I think the Aurora Colony Historical Society has been in existence. A group of businessmen and people, you know, said, "Look, we got to do something with this. We're running to the point where we got to start saving this stuff."
Right, it's going to start falling apart.
Yeah, and it's going to go away, and it's going to fall apart. And so, through their wise foresight, it was started, and we've been gathering artifacts for the last 50 years.
Yeah.
And now we have an adequate place to store those and keep those for perpetuity.
Well, Spud and Carolyn, thank you so much for your time telling us about this. Thank you for your work. This really is a fabulous place, and to you and all the volunteers that have made it happen. If you've never been, definitely come on the 2 days a week that they're going to be open.
You can call us, check
that website.
You know, if something doesn't work out, we can figure something out.
Yeah.
And if you get a wild hair, as they say back in the Ozarks, if you get a wild hair and you want to come on a Wednesday or Friday that morning, give us a call.
Yeah.
Remember, our office hours are kind of limited right now, but if you leave a message on our answering machine, we will call you back as soon as we can. We'll get something arranged.
And we're thinking that in the fall, if depending upon what we end up doing with schools, it kind of sounds to me like kids are not going to be going to school 5 days a week.
Yeah.
Or they may be on a split thing. I think this we certainly want to investigate having a place where school kids can come here even with their parents and learn a little bit of
That'd be great. Yeah, well, let us know about that so we can get that out to people. Spud, you and I are going to take a walk around and see at least a few things here.
Sure.
You guys will hear about them, but if you want to actually come see them, give them a call and set up a tour. Thank you, guys. We're going to take a quick break.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. Mm-hmm. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate, and we got in a carriage ride with the horse, and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time. And sometimes it's a couple months, sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life.
Mm-hmm. How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
Ingenious, really.
Yeah.
It is. Well, they're on for you. They were new. And this was. This should be locked too.
Yeah. I like that.
You want to? You can go back in there and look if you want, since it's open.
Okay. Well, I was gonna ask. This might be a good time if you think any of these places are haunted. So.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Of course.
Oh sure.
And I would disagree.
So tell us a little bit about where we are.
Well, this is the, it's an example. This obviously is probably not the original workshop, wood workshop, but it's clearly indicated, set up to be an example of the many, many types of woodworking that they did. They made everything from furniture to farm implements to saws. All hand done, really good example of hand drills and, excuse me.
Are these but, their shoes that they would make?
No, these are actually, these are old block planes and of various different sizes. And it has a blade here, and you would take a rough piece of lumber, and then this would be used to smooth that wood down into a smooth surface.
Okay.
This one obviously is set up for a curved, you know, like for a molding.
Yeah.
This would be an edging, another piece of molding where it would curve, do a cove molding, and these are all adjusted. Single block planes, two-handed block planes.
Cool.
Yeah. There's a whole cabinet over here, Tyler, of some older examples.
And these are all skills that they brought with them from Bethel?
From Germany.
Yeah, from Germany and Bethel.
Yeah.
This is a pretty cool tool here. This is a apple corer and a slicer. You just bring the apples in, put a basket down, just do them, and they just drop on. Everything is as efficient as it can. This is a pretty unique tool, a very specific tool. This is called a Schnitzelbank.
And delicious.
It is. The sole purpose of a Schnitzelbank is to take a square piece of wood and make a round peg or a dowel out of it. And right now it's not doing much, but I have to put my foot on this brace down here, and that holds it in place. And then I can take... And particularly when they used mortise and tenon construction, as in the barns or the big warehouses, everything was spit with mortise and tenon, and then they would drill a hole through it, and then a wooden dowel would actually hold that all together. And this Schnitzelbank was the tool that you would use to make all of those wooden dowels. And this happens to be a very old one. I think this was period to the colony, but outside, you'll see about a half a dozen replicas of this. And when we have our living history program for our fourth grade students, they actually get to use the Schnitzelbank and make a round peg.
But they get a kick out of that.
Yeah. They do a number of things during that activity. They use a crosscut saw. They use a bow saw. They make dip a candle. Here's an example of kids. This is some of the kids made how they're making the round peg. We start out like this, and then they take these hand drills and they drill a hole in a piece of wood, and that ends up being the base for the candle that they make. So they end up with a candle and a candlestick holder.
Cool.
Interesting story out at the Stauffer Will Farm. We had a water pump, and the tank went bad. And so I called up a local contractor from Canby, probably remain nameless for this podcast, but they sent three gentlemen out, and they were delivered this tank, and they were installing it. And all of them were kind of standing around looking at bewildered to each other. And one of them said, do you have the feeling that you've been here before? And one of the guys said, yeah. He said, we came here in the fourth grade and did this program. And these guys were in their late 30s. So it was 20 years ago, and they still had, very distinct memories of this. So, yeah, it is. And they'll use these saws. These are called bow saws or buck saws. And they'll cut a piece of filbert wood, and then they'll split it. Right by your right knee is actually a mortise from a mortise and tenon construction.
Okay.
This one is very old and it's very wormy, but we still use it. Take a beam and they cut a notch in it called a mortise, and then a tenon is made to slip inside of that. They didn't have big spikes or metal brackets or whatever. And then they would drill a hole through this round hole, use a Schnitzelbank to make that dowel to shove that together. I think there, as I look at this right here, Tyler, I think here would be the tenon that would go in there. And then this would be just an example of that. We have mortise and tenon construction with the hole completed in there. You drive that hole in there, and
gotcha.
It'll stand for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
It'll stand for hundreds
with of years. With no nails or anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
And they had, not only woodworking, they had metal shops, and they have a blacksmith forge. And they used to do all kinds of metalworking, wheelwright. They would make wagon wheels, and Cool. Obviously, any saw blades, you know, that's beyond, they're better off. That's technology. They'd buy that.
Okay. Yeah. Let's have a look at the washhouse.
Okay, we can do that.
So that's after a long day of woodworking, this is where the clothes might end up.
Yeah, yeah. And here's another copy of that Aurora Blue.
Yeah. All right, so for the podcast, tell the listeners about the Aurora Blue.
Well, this particular color of blue, kind of a robin egg blue, still being used today. The finches that are scattered throughout town that were put together by the Visitors Association Chamber of Commerce are all painted in this historic blue color.
Yeah.
It's very important for us as a museum when we get artifacts donated or we find availability of artifacts, particularly in furniture, one of the first things we do is check to see if there's remnants of that old blue color, because then it's bulletproof. Then we know that it's for sure from the colony. It does not mean that all the furniture was painted blue, but it was certainly a prominent color within the.
Yeah, and it's definitely robin egg blue-ish, but with a very kind of timeless, vintagey
very much
quality.
So.
A little bit of gray tinge in there. Does that wash basin have a little of the old blue?
It certainly looks like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly looks like it.
Interesting. So.
And they didn't have drain boards back then. This is what they used. You know, this was the drain board.
That's like a big changing table.
That's what it does now. But
that's my experience.
It had a completely different meaning. A lot of old copper boilers and metal ones that they would. You know, back then they had to heat the water.
Yep.
And they would take those big pots, hang them on here, build a fire underneath there, bring it out, use that washer. And you can imagine in the winter months when it's cold and damp outside.
Yeah.
How do you get your clothes dry? You know, how do you wash them?
Right, during those 10 months of the year.
Sure, during the 10 months of the year. So they would actually wash them in here and take them upstairs and dry them. They would do in the summertime, you know, harvest. They had big meals to cook. They would come out, and this would be the outside cookhouse. Like in the next couple of days, it's supposed to get very, very warm. You don't want to be cooking in your house, cooking dinner and making jams. You got to remember that in the busy time of the year, the summer time of the year, usually July and August, all your fruits and vegetables are coming ripe. You have to do all the canning, the preservation.
Yeah.
The stove would be running 24 hours a day, or at least 16 hours a day in the house. You don't want that. You want to get it outside.
Yeah.
I showed you a little bit earlier, Tyler, about the drying racks. This is a really good example of that, how they would do that. In the fall of the year, when they would, you know, you had no refrigeration. So you had to preserve your meat. You had to smoke it, make sausage, hams, bacon, or can it. That's actually an old sausage press, as well as this. They would grind up a quality of meat, clean the casings. The casings are actually the gut of the animal itself, the hog. And they would put sausage ground meat in there and slip the casing on there.
Do I need to lock it for the
shop? Yeah. And then they'd use this tool right here and apply gentle pressure on it, and the meat would come out through that tube and fill the casing.
Yeah, so you're literally telling us how the sausage is made.
Absolutely, yeah. And then once they had that fresh sausage made, then they'd put it out in the smokehouse and cure it.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's just a simple, you know, it's the concept of leverage.
It's like a, obviously not, but for the listeners, sort of a coffee can looking.
It's about the same size as a, you know, a large coffee can, only a little bit taller with a spout coming out the bottom.
Spout on it, And just shoot that meat.
And then also, I've been a big thing, because they were German, a very big thing that they did was sauerkraut making. They made a lot of sauerkraut.
Yeah.
And you'll see here in front of us, a very large stone crock.
Uh-huh.
Right there is a really large sauerkraut cutter, as is this. You take the sauerkraut, put it in the box, run it over here, and it'd cut out thin slices of cabbage. Mm. And then you would pack it in the crocks with the tamper, add nothing but salt.
Mm-hmm.
Usually ratio of that. I happen to make a lot of sauerkraut myself, so it's 5 pounds of cabbage and 3 tablespoons of salt. So.
Oh, that's all. Wow.
Yeah. And then you pack it down and...
No water or anything.
No.
The water that it has. Okay.
Yeah, just the water that's in the cabbage itself.
Wow. And how long would they leave it for?
Sauerkraut is usually made best in the fall. At that time, the cabbage has a lot more water in it. And you don't need to add any supplemental water. So make it in November. And depending upon the outside ambient temperature, mm-hmm. you know, it would probably be ready in a couple months.
Mm.
If you kept it inside in a heated environment, maybe as little as a month.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't, it's a fine line. You don't want to get it too warm. You don't want to get it too cold, because then it stops fermenting.
Gotcha. Whiskey.
Golden Rule whiskey. That's an interesting story. I don't know the history of distilling Golden Rule whiskey, but the story that I have been always told is that when Dr. Kyle was getting ready to move out west, he had a young son named Willie who was looking forward to the trip. And Dr. Kyle said, Willie, you're going out west. You're going to Oregon with us.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Willie died before they left for the trip. Mm-hmm. Very shortly before, as a matter of fact. And Dr. Kyle put him in a lead-lined casket and filled it full of Golden Rule whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
And drove him on the back end of a wagon all the way from Bethel, Missouri to out west.
Wow. Why?
Promised his son he'd take him to Oregon.
Hmm.
So he was, above all else, he was a man of his word.
Hmm. That's a fun story.
Yeah, and it was, I have heard stories, I can't substantiate it, only probably our past curator, Patrick Harris, could do that, but I have heard many times that it was very beneficial on the way out west, because when they came out in 1856, there were a lot of Indians on the way.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as the Indians found out that this wagon train was carrying a dead body, they kind of just backed off and let them go their way.
There you go. Defense mechanism. That's why I always carry a dead body around with me, just in case.
Hey, Frankie, you okay? You seem kind of down.
Yeah, just bummed. Miss going to the Wild Hair. I know you can still get takeout and all, but it's just not the same.
You know they're open again, right?
What?
Yeah, they've been open for a while now. Don't you cover, like, the news?
Hey, I'm only human, okay?
Okay. Well, I can tell you that the Wild Hare and their amazing staff are thrilled to be open again for delicious meals and fun times. They are strictly following all the recommended safety guidelines, and they have the only covered outdoor patio in Canby, with lots of tables spaced 6 feet apart and umbrellas also spaced 6 feet apart, and fantastic ambiance. And hey, if you're still more comfortable with carryout, they can hook you up there too. Find their menu and other information online at thewildhairsaloon.net or check them out in Cambie and Oregon City. Anything to add, Frankie? Frankie? Oh, I guess he left. God, he must have been really hungry. The Cambie Now podcast is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Cambie by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. Find more of her work at olivia13.com.
The Cambie Now podcast is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The Cambie Now podcast is a production of Now Hear This Studios, Cambie's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
So I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.